From Ground Zero, this is Democracy Now in Exile, the War and Peace Report.
I purposely want to stand next to Muslims and Christians and Jews and members of all other faiths for one simple reason, because terrorism does not want us to stand together. The most effective response here is that we of different faiths stand together.
We do not want to become the evil that we condemn, and I think that's a really beautiful way to put it.
People flee Afghanistan fearing a U.S. attack. We go to Lebanon to speak with Robert Fisk, who interviewed Osama bin Laden, and we'll hear from peace activists who march throughout the country. Stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile, Resistance Radio, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Pakistan sent a group of high-ranking military officers to Afghanistan today to demand the Taliban government hand over the accused Osama bin Laden and his top associates to the United States or face almost certain U.S. military action. The group is led by one of the top officers in Pakistan's military intelligence wing, which is thought to have unique intelligence on bin Laden's operations in Afghanistan and his whereabouts. But Pakistani officials caution that the chance of the Taliban bowing to the American demand is slim. The Taliban leader, Mullah Mohammed Omar, has already said in a defiant, warlike radio speech on Friday he believed handing over bin Laden would not spare Afghanistan from a U.S. attack. The Pakistani president, General Pervez Musharraf, agreed to relay the ultimatum after days of intensive discussions with U.S. officials. General Musharraf reportedly assured President Bush in a telephone call on Saturday that Pakistan would allow the use of its airspace and airfields if needed, as well as full access to Pakistani intelligence on bin Laden. According to the Pakistani officials, U.S. officials had told General Musharraf's government that Washington would use every lever short of war to punish Pakistan unless it cooperated. General Musharraf was said to have made a number of demands in return for Pakistan's cooperation, including an end to economic sanctions imposed by Washington after Pakistan tested nuclear weapons in 1998, the lifting of an American ban on weapon sales, a pledge that Washington would assist Pakistan's battered economy by encouraging generous treatment by the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, and a shift in Pakistan's favor and its dispute with India over the Kashmir region. Meanwhile, Pakistani civilians gathered to protest their government's collaboration with the United States. This news from Afghanistan, tens of thousands of Afghans are streaming out of major cities and headed toward the borders with Pakistan and Iran. Amid fears, the United States is preparing to unleash a war on the land that has harbored Osama bin Laden. Iran has sealed its border with Afghanistan. Taliban officials of Afghanistan's ruling Taliban movement have also started to flee the capital, Kabul. Yesterday, the Taliban ordered all foreigners out, saying their safety could no longer be guaranteed. These who couldn't leave were bracing for war, stocking up on food as prices soared and the Afghani currency slid. Meanwhile, Mullah Mohammed Omar, the Taliban supreme leader, summoned religious scholars to the capital to discuss waging a jihad, a holy war, against the U.S. Nearly 1,000 elders and Islamic scholars from across Afghanistan are expected to attend a meeting tomorrow. More than 3,000 U.S. Marines and sailors rehearsed helicopter and ship-to-shore landings off East Timor Sunday amid expectations of a revenge strike over the terror attacks on New York and Washington. The task force from the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit and Amphibious Squadron 1 had been due to disembark troops for humanitarian work in Dili, the capital of and Swai and Wakusi enclave in Indonesian West Timor. Instead, three amphibious ships led by the 40,000-ton USS Peleliu stayed off the north coast of the capital, practicing naval and air maneuvers with Harrier jets, helicopters, and landing craft. Before two passenger jets slammed into the Twin Towers of New York's World Trade Center and a third into the Pentagon in Washington, the warships were on a routine 6-month deployment to the Western Pacific and Arabian Gulf. U.S. Army spokesperson Major Paul Van Bremen told Reuters and Dili the task force is due to sail for the Wayakusi enclave today to deliver humanitarian supplies before heading to Singapore. He said, after that, I'm not really sure they'll go, but they're part of a much bigger force. And Bush administration officials said yesterday they're considering lifting a 25-year-old ban on U.S. involvement in foreign assassinations and loosening restrictions on FBI surveillance. They said the Justice Department plans to send a wide-ranging set of proposals to Capitol Hill this week that would include more power to conduct wiretaps, detain foreigners, and track money laundering cases. Vice President Cheney said yesterday that CIA field officers may be allowed to recruit and pay overseas agents linked to terrorist groups and human rights abuses, saying it was necessary to infiltrate suspected terrorist cells. In addition, Florida Democratic Senator Bob Graham, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, says he'll introduce a counterterrorism package next week that would create a counterterrorism czar inside the White House and establish authority for the CIA to recruit unsavory agents. And Secretary of State Colin Powell says the administration is reviewing an executive order issued by President Gerald Ford in 1976 that bans U.S. personnel from engaging in or conspiring to engage in assassinations. Some intelligence and terrorism experts have advocated assassinating Osama bin Laden, the exiled Saudi millionaire who lives in hiding in Afghanistan and has been named by the United States as the prime suspect in last week's attacks. The Senate last week approved legislation that would make it easier for the FBI to get warrants for electronic surveillance of computer transmissions. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Patrick Leahy, the Vermont Democrat, called the measure overly broad and an encroachment on civil liberties. He said, we have to be careful in our horror and revulsion over this horrendous and terrible act, that we don't start giving away the freedoms that make us different from terrorists. Several Democrats said many senators did not know exactly what they were voting on and supported the measure in their determination to condemn terrorism. Time will tell. Bob Marley and the Wailers here on Democracy Now! In Exile Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials from Afghanistan's ruling Taliban movement have started to flee the capital, Kabul, amid growing expectations of U.S. attacks. Fear of reprisal has triggered a rush to get families out of the cities. Thousands of people have flooded over the eastern border to the already overflowing refugee camps of Pakistan. Those who couldn't leave are bracing for war, stocking up on food as prices soar and the Afghan currency slides. With Iran announcing it is sealing its eastern border with Afghanistan, opposition fighters controlling a narrow northern corridor, and Pakistan pledging to support U.S. anti-terrorism efforts, Kabul residents are feeling increasingly vulnerable. Afghanistan is already one of the poorest countries after more than 20 years of invasion, occupation, and civil war. A team of senior Pakistan officials is to fly to Kandahar today to press the ruling Taliban to hand over Osama bin Laden and help prevent a potential catastrophe in the region. The Taliban, however, continue to insist neither they nor bin Laden had the capacity to organize an international plot that saw trained pilots hijack large passenger jets in Boston and Washington. The spiritual leader of Afghanistan's ruling Taliban movement, Mullah Muhammad Omar, yesterday called an urgent council of senior Islamic clerics to discuss the situation. Mullah Omar on Saturday issued a call for jihad against the United States and neighboring states such as traditional supporter Pakistan if they attacked or assisted an attack on Afghanistan. We're joined right now by Thomas Gutierrez. He serves as the Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and is the Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at UNO. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you tell us the latest you're hearing now from Afghanistan?
Well, I'm not hearing much. Afghanistan doesn't have much electricity and it has no trunk lines. But what I'm hearing, of course, is that we have a situation where the Pakistanis are meeting with the Taliban to try and convince them to turn over Osama bin Laden, as you indicated. And I think there's an important element to this whole matter. Well, the Taliban and Osama bin Laden were brought together, in fact, by the Pakistanis in the late spring and summer of 1996. The Pakistani military has had a strategic objective in Afghanistan and Central Asia, largely because of its concern about its eastern borders. So Afghanistan, being to the west, has been the central piece in something that the Pakistanis call strategic Islamic depth. And in Afghanistan, after the Soviet war, due to reasons that are too long to go into here, but there was a vacuum that was created by the inability of any of the resistance parties to put together an effective government. And eventually the Pakistanis, who had been backing some of them, realized that they were not going to be successful and backed the Taliban, another group that rose up in Afghanistan during this period. And it was a group that was very dependent upon Pakistan's military, particularly its intelligence, military strategy, and also recruits from Pakistan's extremist religion, madrasa schools. And thousands literally came to Afghanistan to fight on behalf of the Taliban against the other particular warlords within Afghanistan. When I was there in 96, 97, working with the United Nations Special Mission to Afghanistan, I saw convoys of these people, none of whom could speak Persian or Pashto, the two major languages of Afghanistan, because they were indeed not Afghans. Into this mix, the Pakistanis brokered the return of Osama bin Laden, who had been fighting on behalf of the Afghans against the Soviets and left, went back to Saudi Arabia, was thrown out of there for demonstrating against American presence there and against the lacking of Islamic character of the Saudi regime, went to Sudan to establish training camps to fight against the West now, and then was thrown out of there due to Saudi and American pressure, and went back to Afghanistan as a result of the efforts of the Pakistani Army's military intelligence to put them together, the Taliban and Osama bin Laden, both to help them, the Pakistanis, achieve their objectives. So you've asked me what I know about now. I'm trying to give you a kind of a background of all the characters now, all the players in this very moment who are meeting one with each other in some form or another, and how it plays together. This is what I would call an unholy alliance that was constituted in 1996. The Pakistanis recognize that the whole situation is becoming a real mess for them, because Pakistan is on the verge in some ways of becoming a failed state because of the unrest in the country, the ineffectiveness of the democratic governments that preceded this latest version of the military government. And they know that a lot of the people who were young people who were trained for fighting in Afghanistan and Kashmir, when coming back, are not pleased with what they consider to be the lack of extreme Islamic nature of their government either. So they've got their own kind of chickens coming home to roost, and they probably see this as an opportunity to reestablish control in a secular fashion over their nation.
What about the relationship between U.S. intelligence, which helped to train Osama bin Laden and other Islamic militants in Afghanistan in fighting the Soviets, along with the British intelligence and Pakistani intelligence, and their relationship with these intelligence organizations today?
Well, I think we need to understand that that was going on, and but I think that the primary contacts between Osama bin Laden and anything that was going on relating to this war was through the Pakistani intelligence. That's not to say that it didn't have at least some connection with our own interests and objectives and strategies there. The thing to remember is that was a different era. In 1989, the Soviet Union left Afghanistan in ignominious defeat. At Thanksgiving time that same year, 1989, the Berlin Wall fell, and by the end of 1991, the Soviet Union was history. That was a different era, a different time, and you got to remember that those were the Afghans who remained behind to fight against the Soviet Union. And a lot of the others left and went to be refugees, but these people fought. And unfortunately, as I indicated earlier, those who did the fighting were unable themselves to put together a cohesive government because this was a tribal society. They had worked centuries to create a social fabric, a social infrastructure. The war, the Soviet war, devastated and ruined the country. It looks like Berlin after the Second World War, even to this day. And so it became Humpty Dumpty. All those pieces fell apart, and it takes not just one, two, or three generations to put them back together, but it took Afghanistan, two centuries to put that together. And so into that vacuum, were coming extremist, forms of government, because unfortunately, this is a part of U.S. policy, which is an unfortunate element to this. We backed away from Afghanistan, and we're trying to help the Russians emerge from their Soviet past. That's where we put our primary focus, not really recognizing, unfortunately, that stability in Afghanistan, Central Asia, and Pakistan was going to have even more of an impact on what might happen in Russia and that part of the world in the long term than just our policy there. I think we did the right thing with Russia, but we did the wrong thing with Afghanistan, and we need to be able to carry on more than one policy effectively at the same time.
Professor Thomas Gutierrez, can you give us a picture of Afghanistan, for example, Kabul, and the places that people are fleeing from right now? What is it exactly, if the U.S. bombed, they would be bombing?
Well, people say that they're, that it's possible to bomb Afghanistan back into the Stone Age. I can tell you it's already there. I lived in Kabul for 10 years myself in the 60s and 70s. And it used to be a very beautiful city and a very, very picturesque country with dramatic, vistas and everything, high mountains and beautiful little valleys. But today, Afghanistan is a ruined, skeleton of its former self. And but the thing to remember is that there are many, 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 many Afghans inside the country who would just as soon be rid of these extremist Taliban and also these foreigners on their soil. Afghans have never welcomed foreigners on their soil. So now we have, these foreigners there. They'd like to get rid of them, and there are a lot of Afghans who I'm certain will be willing to work with us to try and remove Osama bin Laden and the Taliban if they are not willing to cooperate.
Finally, what do you think at this point in terms of the Pakistani political landscape, the U.S. military operations being, I don't know if it's based in Pakistan, using the airspace, et cetera, in terms of how it will affect the country?
Well, I think it's going to be difficult for the Pakistanis. They've created themselves, they've helped to create a situation that is difficult for them now to live with if they're to have a tenable future as a nation state. And so we're cooperating with them. I think we need to go in this, though, with our eyes wide open, because in the past 10 years, the Pakistanis have repeatedly lied to us about their intentions in Afghanistan and their connections with Osama bin Laden and the Taliban. They have been intimate throughout this time, very intimate, and they've denied this, but it's not true. And I witnessed this firsthand as a member of the United Nations Special Mission to Afghanistan and subsequent trips. And it's an unfortunate thing. You have one part of the Pakistani government telling you something, And then you have the military, and particularly the military intelligence, doing something else in league with extremists in their own country and Osama bin Laden and other extremists from the Persian Gulf.
What does it mean that Afghanistan has deployed 25,000 troops, according to the Washington Post, on the Pakistan-Afghani border?
Well, I'm not sure that all those troops are Afghan. I think large numbers of them are probably Arab and certainly Pakistani. One must understand, while these troops may be highly disciplined religiously, their military discipline is of another nature. And many of them, when I would meet in Afghanistan and various parts when I was there, during the UN period, didn't like to be in the military more than 6 months, and they just came home on their own. And I think it's possible for some of those to be peeled off if it appears that the situation is not very good for the Taliban at this time.
Russian intelligence is saying that they were keeping tabs on Osama bin Laden just before the strike, and then don't have information on him. What do you think are the possibilities of or the extensiveness of the U.S. Russian intelligence on Osama bin Laden and his whereabouts?
The intelligence apparatus that has the best knowledge of Osama bin Laden and his whereabouts right now is the Pakistani military intelligence, and they likely know where he is.
Do you think that Afghanistan will turn Osama bin Laden over with this Pakistani delegation going to ask that they do?
I think Afghans in Afghanistan would love to do that. I think the Taliban at this stage don't appear likely to want to do that. I have difficulty associating Afghanistan and Taliban together, because the Taliban really are I consider them to be an entity that really has no concept of a nation state and is not really able to think in terms of the interest of the population of Afghanistan. The leader of the Taliban, Mullah Omar, takes instructions only from God, and the Pakistanis and the Arabs who are surrounding him as advisors. And I don't have a lot of faith that we'll be able to get much in the way from him. He's like those who crashed into the trade towers, probably believing that if he dies in the struggle, he'll serve as a martyr and go straight to heaven. But there are many Afghans who'd like to be able to reconstruct the country that they love so much, that has been fighting against the Soviets and now this mess for the last 10 years, who'd like to be to bring their country back to what at least it was before the war began. And that will take a long, long time.
What is the relationship between the Taliban and Osama bin Laden? Why do they protect him?
Because they're very dependent upon him. Most of the Taliban's fighters on the front line against the other Afghans in the country are members of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden's group, and also those who have been trained in his camps, in his training camps. So, that's the relationship. In many ways, Osama bin Laden's military forces are stronger than those of the Afghan Taliban movement. I regret to have to tell you, I need to go right now.
Thank you very much for spending the time with us. Tomas Gutierre is Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and the University of Nebraska Medical Center. He's Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at UNO. Tomas Gutierre spent 10 years in Afghanistan. He was with the Peace Corps. You are listening to Democracy Now in Exile. In this program, you'll be hearing a peace vigil of thousands that took place yesterday, looking from Brooklyn at the World Trade Center, the World Trade Center-less skyline of Lower Manhattan. It was a vigil to show support for Arab Americans and Muslims. We will also be speaking with Robert Fisk in Lebanon. He's interviewed Osama bin Laden as well. He's interviewed one of the parents of a man who has been blamed for the terror attacks in the United States. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. Back in a minute. Listening to Ground Zero Radio, the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now! In Exile. We're broadcasting just blocks from what used to be the towers of the World Trade Center. This weekend, not much luck with finding anyone alive in the rubble. It looks like somewhere around, well, more than 5,000 people continue to be, if you can use the term, entombed or incinerated by the attacks of last Tuesday, both in New York, the World Trade Center towers attack, and the attack in Washington, D.C. on the Pentagon. We are at a firehouse, downtown community television, just below Canal Street. We spent last week since the attacks here because we were afraid we would not be able to come in to broadcast if we ever left the site. We are in the evacuation zone. It's loosened up a bit over the weekend. A lot of the emergency vehicles are just a block away from us on Broadway and in that area as hundreds of emergency workers continue to get rid of, in a very painstakingly slow process, the rubble to still try to find some people who might be alive. But right now, well, we're going to go to another borough, and that's Brooklyn, because at about 5 o'clock, thousands of people gathered at Court Street and Atlantic Avenue, the heart of the Arab American community, to show their support for Arab Americans and Muslims. Perhaps an unlikely sound that was part of this vigil as people walked from the Arab American business district to the promenade that looks out on the southern landscape of Manhattan, used to be the World Trade Center towers, now simply smoke. An unlikely sound at this vigil was the sound of the shofar that will be heard around the country and around the world tonight for the beginning of the holiest days of the Jewish New Year, and that is Rosh Hashanah. The sound of the shofar was blown last night for the Muslims and Arab Americans and their saints and their safety.
Amen. بسم الله الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا رسول الله اللهم ارحم الأموات
آمين
اللهم ارحم الأموات
آمين
اللهم ارحم الأموات
آمين
اللهم ارزق أهلهم وذويهم الصبر والسلوان
آمين
وعوضهم خيرا يا رب العالمين
آمين
اللهم عليك بالمجرمين فإنهم لا يعجزونك
آمين
اللهم عليك بهم جميعا فإنهم لا يعجزونك
آمين
صلي اللهم على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم
Thank you. My name is Khadr El-Yateem. My main concern at the church is to make sure our people are safe and they are not discriminated against and nobody is attacked because they are Arabs. Because as New Yorkers, as Americans, we are also affected by this tragedy, and we have our own losses in this tragedy. And we just try to work with the community to participate as much as we can, to offer whatever we can to the community for the healing process.
Which is your church?
It's Salam Arabic Lutheran Church in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn.
And who have you lost?
Well, we have, not directly from our church, but from our community, we have two people who died in the crash. Yeah. And we have a few people from our church who've been attacked because they are Arabs.
What has happened to them?
One person, some of the people went and threw eggs at his house. The other person, about five or seven youth, went to his store, destroyed the sign, threw dirt on the goods he has in the store, and wrote some words, graffiti, which is insulting.
What is being done about that?
Well, we are working closely with the police and with the city council, Marty Golden, to try to bring peace and unity. And we did two meetings already in our church, bringing the community to speak about peace and understanding and to promote this unity in our community. So we've been taking an active role to participate and help in any way we can.
You said you're Palestinian-American?
Yes, I'm Palestinian Christian, yes.
Mm-hmm. What about the response in the occupied territories right now?
Well, everybody there is saddened by the attack, and I've been in very close touch with my family there, and they're still in shock. They couldn't believe it, or they still cannot believe it, that this has happened.
Where does your family live?
We live in Beit Jala, which is 5 minutes north of Bethlehem.
Can you give me your phone number to be in touch with you?
748.
And your name?
K-H-A D-E-R. You need the last name? E-L-Y-A-T.
You're listening to E-E-L. The sounds of the vigil for Arab Americans and Muslims.
Well, last question.
Yes.
What do you think of the possibility of a retaliatory attack?
Well, I think that will be so soon to speak about that, but I strongly disagree with it until we find out exactly what happened and how to deal with the situation. I do not support it at this time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Joe Potasnik, rabbi of Congregation Mount Sinai here in Brooklyn Heights. I purposely want to stand next to Muslims and Christians and Jews and members of all other faiths for one simple reason, because terrorism does not want us to stand together. And therefore, the most effective response here is that we of different faiths stand together.
I'm Andrew Stettner, and I'm with Jews for Racial and Economic Justice. And you know, we're here today because we're shuddering that the impact of the World Trade Center attack is being felt all over the country by Arab Americans and Muslims. There have been over 200 attacks in the country, and Arab Americans say they're increasing. And we're very afraid, and we're afraid that the lives of those who are lost will be taken in vain by bombings throughout the Islamic world. So we're here with a lot of fear and really shuddering at the impact, but confident and hopeful that there's beginning to be a popular movement that is beginning to say this is not the way to mourn just an incredibly terrible loss that we're all bearing.
Salam, shalom, three easy words. Peace, salam, shalom, come sing with us. Peace, salam, shalom, three easy words. Peace, salam, shalom, come sing with us. Peace, salam, shalom, come sing with us. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom.
My name is Purvi Shah. I'm a board member at Sakhi for South Asian Women. And I'm here today, one, because one of my friends was in two World Trade Center and she is still missing, Swarna Chelasani, who is a longtime Sakhi volunteer. I'm also here today not only to condemn the terrorist attack and to grieve, but also because there has been a lot of anti-Muslim and anti-Arab American violence in the city and across the nation. And we wanted to condemn both the violence of the terrorist attacks and the violence and hate crimes that are occurring now. Swarna worked as a part of Sakhi for peace in her everyday life. She worked with battered women to advocate for peace, to advocate their health and safety. And I think it's so sad to see that the outcome of this terrorist attack has been to create more violence in our lives instead of more peace. And so we wanted to share with other people of all faiths, all ethnicities, all cultural backgrounds, a stand for peace, and to really question what we're doing here. What does it mean to retaliate? What does it mean to have a war on terrorism? What does it mean to have a war on terrorism when you're going to terrorize innocent people? And to really raise those questions as ordinary citizens, because I think right now it seems like we're helpless. It seems like there's not much we can do, but it's really our voices that matter and count right now. So that's part of why we came here today.
What do you think of the media coverage of the attack and the aftermath?
I think, I saw the buildings fall from my Brooklyn window, and I've been consistently re-traumatized by seeing that image played over and over again, especially having a friend who is missing. It's a traumatic scene to see continuously the buildings fall and all the mayhem. I wish the media would focus on a lot of the healing and grieving and energy that people are putting into making a healing ceremony or a peace out of this terrible tragedy that's happened. And I also feel that the media has not been very critical of the president's warmongering stance on this whole situation. I feel like the media has fed into his approach of dealing with this situation by continuously displaying these scenes of grieving and heightening the tragedy in that way. Whereas I feel like BBC World and other media in other countries have noticed the ways in which this tragic attack does not come out of nowhere, that it has a historical series of precedents. The media has covered the ways in which Israeli tanks are now in the West Bank and the other kinds of after effects that this tragedy has had. In fact, terrorism wants to splinter us apart, and we are helping that to happen. We are helping to fuel the war that bin Laden would want us to have. And I feel it's the media's responsibility, as well as the responsibility of everyday people and our government who are refusing to act in peaceful ways, to create other options and to of course bring these terrorists to justice, but also not to produce more injustice in the world. I think one of the religious leaders at the National Prayer Ceremony said it so well. He said that we do not want to become the evil that we condemn, and I think that's a really beautiful way to put it.
Hi, this is Tom Tomorrow. We came down here to express our belief, our fervent hope that Arab Americans do not become a target of bigotry and hatred as a result of the terrible thing that we've all seen.
I'm sorry, I haven't seen if you've done any cartoons recently, have you?
Yeah, I've done a couple. I'm trying not to... this is going to be a very polarizing time, a very divisive time, and I'm trying... I think it's important to try to have a dialogue. I don't want to only preach to the choir at this point. So I did what I thought was very... very reasonable, very sort of low-key, just talking about how my sense that retaliation might lead to something worse, how we don't want to use this as an excuse to target Arab Americans, and how we don't want to see this used as an excuse to pull civil liberties. And even just that very, very, very measured thing has just gotten me a ton of very, very hateful email. People effectively comparing my work as a cartoonist in the newspaper with the act of the people who did this thing to us. And I'm just worried. I'm very worried about what's going to happen, but I'm worried that we're headed into a very divisive time, and I don't want to see it, and I don't know how to stop it, because people's immediate reaction is to, you know, is to gather together in the fort, and any voice of dissent whatsoever is sedition, is treasonous. And in fact, anyone is appalled by this, and certainly any decent thinking person believes that the people who did this should be brought to justice. There are just some of us who don't want to see the slaughter of innocent civilians responded to by slaughtering more innocent civilians. But I'm not even sure if I'm not even sure if you're going to be able to say that anymore. I'm not even sure if anyone's going to listen. The moment you suggest that there's any other course of action than a hardcore military strike, people just shut down. They won't listen. And I think on the left and the right, we've really all got to take a deep breath and listen to each other, because we are all Americans here. Nobody wanted this to happen. Nobody believed we should see this terrible destruction, this terrible loss of life. We just, you know, in this democracy, we are just coming at this from different points of view. And we've got to continue to be able to talk that out openly in this democracy, or else these guys have won. And I'm just afraid we're not going to. I'm afraid that's not going to happen.
Where can people see your work?
Well, I got to say, cartoons just don't seem awfully important right now. But you know, if you really don't have anything better to do, you can see it at salon.com.
Cartoonist Tom Tomorrow joining thousands of others last night at a sunset vigil in Brooklyn, in the heart of the Arab American community. It was a vigil to call for the protection of Arab Americans and Muslims in this country, in the face of rising attacks. In fact, this news has just flashed over the BBC website that an Afghani taxi driver was left paralyzed in London after a racist attack. You are listening to Democracy Now in Exile. When we return, we will go to Europe to find out reaction there to the preparations for an imminent attack and to the attacks that took place last week. We're doing a two-hour special today, and for those who are staying with us, Robert Fisk will be joining us from Lebanon to talk about his interview with Osama bin Laden. And we'll also be talking about the legislation, the counterterrorism legislation, that is rapidly being introduced into the House and the Senate that would severely curtail civil liberties and increase surveillance. Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights will be joining us, and we'll be continuing to go into the streets to a rally that took place this weekend in Union Square Park. It was a rally to remember the dead, to give hope to those whose loved ones have not yet been found, and to speak out against war. Stay with us.
Some the light was worth the candle, the warmth was worth the cold, the conversation worth the wine, and what I've learned's been worth growing old. If I leave this world tomorrow, happily, I can say the light was worth the candle. At the end of the day, give it all you've got. Whatever you do, trust your heart. journey's worth more, much more than the gold.
You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile, Ground Zero Radio, just blocks from where the World Trade Center once was and where hundreds of people continue to comb through the rubble, shipping it away. Tons of stones and cement, steel have been taken away over the weekend as the emergency personnel attempt slowly but surely to find at least a living person. It has been a very, very difficult last few days. While the weather has been good, there has been very little hope or finding of people in the rubble. This piece by Ron Howell in Newsday. As New York struggled to return to its bustling self, preparing for the reopening today of public schools and the stock exchange, New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani invoked the memory of Winston Churchill, who 60 years ago rallied the British as they withstood Nazi air attacks on London. Just as Londoners had been heroes, Giuliani said, so too are New Yorkers. He said, we're not the first people that have gone through being attacked, pointing out that he's been reading the book 5 Days in London for Courage over the past week. And in the New York Times today, in a piece by Suzanne Daly, after offering expressions of support immediately following this week's attacks on the United States, European allies are showing signs of backpedaling. The NATO allies have said they could support some military action, but now the caveats are beginning to roll in, making clear that the terror attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon will not translate into an unconditional writ for American retaliation. Particularly as talk in Washington has grown tougher, the allies have begun showing signs they want a carefully thought-out plan to combat terrorism, not a burst of military might that turns out to be brutal and ineffective. Many politicians have begun distancing themselves from Washington's saber-rattling. While President Bush has repeatedly described the terror attacks as acts of war, European officials are going out of their way to avoid such language. On a radio program, the Belgian foreign minister, Louis Michel, said the European Union is on watch and mobilized, but he added, we are not at war. In France, Prime Minister Lionel Jospin has cautioned there is no, quote, war against Islam or the Arab Muslim world. Moreover, he signaled that France would not automatically support military action, saying our humane political and functional solidarity with the United States does not deprive us of our sovereignty and freedom to make up our own minds. We turn now to Paris, France, to Imogen Lam, who is a reporter with RFI, Radio France International. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile.
Thank you. Hello.
It's good to have you with us. Before we talk about Afghanistan, where you were in April, let's talk about France and the political climate there after the attacks on the United States.
I think France, like the other European countries, has reacted with full support for the United States in these very, very difficult times that it's going through, but as you say, has been cautious in the use of the word war. Europe feels that it has to support the United States in these times, but it doesn't want to go so far as to speak of an all-out war in progress here.
What about the French left right now, the whole political spectrum? What kind of response?
What's extraordinary is that reading both right and left-wing newspapers, much of the commentary is very similar in expressing its support for the American people, at the same time pointing out that American foreign policy could very much be responsible in a way for what has happened because of the irresponsible attitude of American leaders in the past few years, to take just Afghanistan as an example, because of the involvement of the American government in that country over the years and the support that it gave the Taliban's in the early years. And in this kind of reaction, there is very little difference, strangely enough, between right and left.
Imogen Lam, you have spent a good deal of time in Afghanistan, most recently in April. Can you talk about Afghanistan today, Afghanistan in the year 2001?
Afghanistan is a country that has been at war for over 20 years. It's a country that's almost totally destroyed. It has few or no infrastructures, and its people have suffered tremendously and are continuing to suffer terrible, unimaginable hardships. And the very thought that they're going to suffer even more in the days or weeks to come is absolutely frightening.
Can you talk about the people there, the people and the government?
Well, I think one has to be very careful when you talk about Afghanistan, you talk about the Taliban. The vast majority of people in Afghanistan are not Taliban. They are Afghan civilians who are suffering an extremely difficult situation. They're people who really have very little left. Many have been forced to flee their homes, forced to flee the country because of war, because of drought, because of famine in the past few years. I was in the center of the country, one of the parts worst hit by drought earlier this year. It hadn't rained there in 3 years. And I spoke to families who'd been forced to flee their villages because of the drought, who had nowhere to go to, who had very little food to eat. I went through villages, towns where there was no more meat available, no eggs, no dairy products, no flour. Afghanistan used to be a big wheat-producing country. It used to export wheat to its neighbors. And in towns, the situation is little better. In Kabul itself, the people are struggling to survive. One quarter of the population is surviving thanks to handouts by international organizations, particularly thanks to subsidized bread. I met many people who live on bread and tea, black tea with no sugar, and that's all that these families are living on right now.
Imogen Lam, what about the women of Afghanistan? An issue that we hear something about. There's an organization, RAWA, the Radical Association of Afghani Women, that we get information from on the web. We have done interviews with them in exile in Pakistan, but there is not a tremendous amount known about what they are going through today.
Well, I can talk to you about the women of Kabul. I spent 2 weeks in Kabul, and I met many women in their homes, although I wasn't allowed to. Women are not allowed to receive foreigners in their homes. Their life is extremely difficult. They're not allowed to go out without a male member of their family to accompany them. They have no work because they're not allowed to work. For many, their husbands are unemployed because unemployment is rife. Since the Taliban took over Kabul, many civil servants were sacked. People don't have jobs. So the women's situation is very difficult. They're having to feed their families with very little money coming in. Many women have sold all their possessions, which is why in the first few months they were able to eat, to buy food. And now I spoke to women who say, we have sold everything. We have borrowed from our neighbors. Our neighbors have nothing anymore. They cannot lend us anything. They've no more food either. We've nothing more to sell. And their situation is really, really very, very serious. Many have fled. Those who could have fled the city have fled abroad, but many more cannot flee. And they're living in their homes, no chance of an education, no chance of a job, no proper food, not enough food to give their children, very little medical treatment at their disposal. So you can imagine what these women are going through right now.
All over the world, it is the case that with war, it is overwhelmingly civilians who suffer the brutality of war. When it comes to Kabul, what would be your picture of what would happen if it's bombed?
Half the city is already completely bombed and destroyed. Many people live in the ruins of the city. For those who do have homes, I can't begin to imagine the devastation because, as you say, it's the civilians who are hit first and foremost in any kind of bombing attack. I imagine that the authorities, most of the Taliban authorities, will have sought shelter, will have taken care of themselves and their families. That leaves the vast majority of the people in Kabul, the civilians, who've nowhere to run to, who've no bomb shelters to go to, and who are going to be totally devastated. Those who are injured will have very little treatment, very little medicine at their disposal. Although there are some hospitals working in Kabul, most of those won't accept women for treatment, for example, or girls. So any girls or women who are injured in any attack there's only one hospital in the city where they can turn to. That treatment was been run with the help of international aid organizations. Those expatriate workers have had to leave the country, so it's unclear at this stage how much aid will remain in the city for people in need of help.
Imogen Lem, how much discussion in France is there now of the involvement in U.S. of the United States in the training, for example, of Osama bin Laden, the CIA's training of him when he came originally to Afghanistan, and also the fact that the U.S. just recently gave $40 million to the Taliban regime, ostensibly for the so-called war on drugs?
Everybody's aware of it. There's a lot on that in the newspapers. People are talking about it. And as I said earlier, people are very supportive of the American people at this time. At the same time, they are talking about the responsibility of successive American governments. And they are saying that the United States can no longer continue this kind of support of Islamic fundamentalist movements. It cannot continue as it has done up till now, its foreign policies, and it's got to reevaluate its position in the world and its involvement in world politics.
Is there a sense that the U.S. will clearly be attacking soon, not exactly clear where, and do people in France feel themselves getting on a war footing?
Most people think that the United States is definitely going to attack. Many think that it will be in Afghanistan. They don't really know who they're going to attack there or how they're going to find Osama bin Laden, for example. They're not so clear about French involvement. France has expressed support, but it's funny, when you talk to the older French men and women, they remember the Americans' role at the end of the Second World War. They remember when the Americans landed in France, and they say the Americans helped us. It's for us to help them now. So I imagine they're thinking more on the terms of military help. The younger people, not necessarily. They think we should be supportive, but not necessarily militarily.
Well, Imogen Lem, I want to thank you very much for being with us from Paris, France, just having returned in April from Afghanistan. And that does it for today's program. For those of you who are staying with us for our second hour, we'll be interviewing Robert Fisk in Beirut, Lebanon. He's interviewed Osama bin Laden, as well as one of the parents of one of the men believed to have been part of the attack on one of the planes that went into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. We'll also be hearing from a peace vigil that took place this weekend in New York. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland at WBIX.org, our spiritual and technical director. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers. We're broadcasting on Channel 34 at Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and our camera person is Karen Renucci. Thank you to the Pacifica stations, especially KPFA and KFCF in Fresno, and of course, all of our affiliate stations around the country. We are Pacifica. Encourage your Pacifica station to tune in to Democracy Now! in Exile. You can also hear us at www.webactive.com. We're broadcasting from downtown community television. We're in the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown. In Exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
I just went on tour. She asked me why. I just went on and told her. She asked me why. I just went on and told her.
That Indian blowing the whistle on the fire main, he rang the bell. That Indian blowing the whistle on